listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a MAPS project so extensive it's taken 40 years of research and work is approaching completion. It all happened here in Wisconsin. We'll talk to the director of the project about what he wants people to get from it and his deep love for MAPS. Now, closing arguments are wrapping up today in the case against Kyle Rittenhouse, the Illinois teenager charged with shooting three people and killing two of them during protests in Kenosha last year. The jury's tasked to determine whether he acted lawfully in self-defense. The judge in the case dismissed a misdemeanor charge against Rittenhouse earlier today. He will allow the jury to consider lesser charges in their verdicts on the remaining counts. We are recapping the prosecution and defense arguments and getting a better understanding of the jury's responsibility. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have questions about the different charges against Rittenhouse or what you've seen or heard about the trial as it's been going on, what do you think of the argument that he was or wasn't acting in self-defense? Do you think Wisconsin law needs to change in any way based on what you've heard about the case? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. John Gross is a clinical associate professor of law at the University of Wisconsin Law School and director of the Public Defender Project. John, welcome to Central Time.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you.
This is a case, obviously, that's gotten attention around the state, around the country. In a courtroom, how insulated can people really be from that knowledge of the wider interest in that case?
Well, I don't think it would be possible to have been in Kenosha for the last year and not have heard something about the case, or really in all of Wisconsin, maybe even the country, because of the level of publicity that it's received. The challenge really for the jurors as they're being selected is to really ask themselves, despite what they may have heard about the case, do they still have an open mind? Can they weigh the evidence that's presented during the trial and come to a verdict that has not been pre-decided?
You've looked, I know, at the jury selection process. How careful are both sides, prosecutor and defense, to try to make sure that they don't get someone who already has their mind made up on the opposite side?
The real focus for them is to, we often say when picking a jury, it's not so much who you're picking to be on the jury, it's the folks that you're trying to remove from the jury. You're deselecting people to serve on the jury because you fear that they may be biased or prejudiced or they may have prejudged the case. And so those are the folks you're trying to kind of weed out. And then you're left with the folks that you hope do have an open mind and can listen to both sides and will judge the case based on the evidence that's presented in the courtroom and not what they've heard about the case through different media sources.
As you look at the different charges, a handful still remaining after the dismissal of that misdemeanor firearms charge, what kind of things are you looking at with what the jury has to decide on based on what both sides have shown them? What kind of standards are required for a guilty verdict on these charges?
Well, the jury always has to be satisfied with any of the charges that the prosecution has proven each element of the case beyond a reasonable doubt. From the defense perspective, I think the defense will be making a fairly straightforward argument to the jury that Mr. Rittenhouse was acting in self-defense, that he was acting reasonably in self-defense that evening. And if the jury believes that, or at the very least, if they do not think that the prosecution has been able to disprove beyond a reasonable doubt that he was acting in self-defense, then he should be acquitted of the remaining charges. The prosecution has a couple of different theories behind how they've charged the case. In one instance, the first person who was shot that night, Mr. Rosenbaum, the prosecution has charged Mr. Rittenhouse with first-degree reckless homicide, which requires that they show utter disregard for human life, that Mr. Rittenhouse acted with utter disregard for human life. But with the other shooting that followed of Mr. Huber, they've charged first-degree intentional homicide so that they need to show that Mr. Rittenhouse indeed intended to kill and caused his death. And they've also charged attempted first-degree intentional homicide with regard to Mr. Grosskreutz. So again, they have to prove that Mr. Rittenhouse attempted to cause his death intentionally.
The judge has instructed the jury, or will be allowing the jury, I understand, to consider different types, possibly lesser charges than the ones the prosecution originally brought. Is that something we would usually see at this stage in a process?
Yes, you would. In fact, Wisconsin by law has lesser forms of homicide are included in more serious forms of homicide. And usually in a case like this, depending on what witnesses the jury might believe or what theory of the case is being argued to them by the defense or the prosecution, it's normal to sort of present to them a range of options, often lesser included offenses, so that they can decide what level of culpability or responsibility they should assign to the defendant's conduct, if they assign any culpability at all. So another sort of level of difficulty, admittedly, for the jury to sort through, but not unexpected.
Talking to John Gross from the UW Law School, director of the Public Defender Project, looking at the closing days of the Kyle Rittenhouse trials. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you've been following the trial, what has struck you? What questions do you have about what you've seen and heard there? Do you have thoughts on the argument over self-defense and whether it should apply? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. John, a lot of attention to Judge Bruce Schroeder and his style of running a court. And apparently, according to a lot of court reporters and judges or lawyers who have argued in front of him, this is just his normal kind of court demeanor. Do you have thoughts on what he's done, some of the decisions he's made along the way?
Well, I too have heard the same thing, that this is his the normal way that he runs his courtroom. I would say that, you know, he does permit himself to give quite a bit of, I think, commentary along the way, which is something that is not always so desirable from the judge. He definitely has spent a lot of time engaging with the lawyers, talking about the jury instructions and other aspects of the case. So I sort of wonder if some of these issues couldn't have been parsed out before the trial began, which would have eliminated the need to have quite so much back and forth between the parties and the judge over different evidentiary issues and different rulings regarding the dismissal of a charge and the eventual decision to how to charge the jury and what lesser included offenses to include. But this appears to be par for the course for him.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Andrew is with us in Palmyra. Andrew, hello.
Hi there. I just wanted to call and comment on the DA Binger's closing arguments. He made a lot of statements that were either factually inaccurate or were in conflict with statements that he made earlier in his closing argument. For instance, he made a comment that there was no cars on the lot that night and that Kyle Rittenhouse could have run away. There was no reason for him to be there. He also made the comment that when he was running away down the street, that he could have fired warning shots even after he said that this rifle had, you know, severe or significant power and was very dangerous. He still made the comment he should have fired warning shots. And lastly, he made the comment that Gage Grosskreutz's arm was blown off when he was shot, and that, you can see in the video, is factually inaccurate. I think he couldn't keep his story straight, and I think it's something worth listening to.
Andrew, thanks for the call. John, did you see? Have you seen problems with the prosecutor's case not conforming to the facts, including the video evidence?
Well, whenever parties make closing arguments, they are free to urge to the jury whatever inferences, whatever conclusions they think was warranted by the evidence. The judge has instructed the jury previously that, you know, whatever the lawyers say in closing argument, it is just that. It's argument. And if the juror's recollection of the facts or the evidence is inconsistent with what the lawyer is presenting to them during closing argument, if they think the testimony was different, it's their recollection that controls in the case, And so, you know, also the defense is listening to that argument, and I'm sure if they felt that the prosecution was mischaracterizing evidence or misstating evidence, they could have objected to it. But generally speaking, you know, you have some leeway when you're giving your closing argument to pick and choose the facts that you want to emphasize to the jury. But again, you know, if the jury is listening to that argument and they believe that the lawyer is stretching the truth or misstating the facts or ignoring other relevant, important facts that were testified to, then that could diminish the strength of their closing argument.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to John Gross, Clinical Associate Professor of Law at the UW Law School, Director of the Public Defender Project, looking at the Kyle Rittenhouse trial coming to a close today. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about what you've seen and heard in the courtroom about what qualifies as self-defense in Wisconsin law? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with John Gross. He's director of the Public Defender Project and a clinical associate professor of law at the UW Law School. We're talking about the Kyle Rittenhouse trial and the decision that faces the jury in Kenosha County. You can join in with your thoughts, your reactions, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I want to give a listen to some of the closing arguments on both sides, especially as it pertains to self-defense. First, here's Assistant District Attorney Thomas Binger for the prosecution saying Rittenhouse can't claim self-defense because he argues he created the danger he faced.
When the defendant provokes the incident, he loses the right to self-defense. You cannot claim self-defense against a danger you create. That's critical right here. If you're the one who is threatening others, you lose the right to claim self-defense.
Now here's defense attorney Mark Richards responding to that argument in his closing arguments today.
He has as much right to go there as anybody else in the city of Kenosha and be unmolested by the likes of Joseph Rosenbaum, Kelly, and Joshua Zeminski.
So that argument about provoking the incident, negating the self-defense, how does a jury suss that out?
Yeah, so I think one of the challenges here for the jury and the difference in the narrative that both sides are presenting is that the prosecution is presenting this as if Mr. Rittenhouse's presence there with this AR-15 assault rifle when there was a curfew in place, when he was arguably not legally entitled to have the weapon, and by carrying it openly amongst people who were engaged in civil disobedience, protesting, that in itself was a type of provocation, that he basically created this dangerous situation and that therefore he would be deprived of his right to act in self-defense. The defense is claiming that he had as much right, as they said, as anybody else to be there and that he was not the aggressor. In fact, Mr. Rosenbaum and some other of the people who were out protesting that evening were the ones who were acting aggressively and erratically toward him, that the entire environment was one where it was dangerous and there were people on both sides acting in ways that sort of caused a heightened level of tension. And so when Mr. Rittenhouse fired, he was doing so in self-defense. He was not the one who had initiated the confrontation between himself and Mr. Rosenbaum.
Let's bring on another caller now at 800-642-1234. Jimmy is with us in Valley Junction. Jimmy, hi.
Yeah, I didn't follow the trial that much, but was he hired by somebody to come up and protect their property? Did he just show up with a high-powered rifle and take that upon himself? I mean, you would think the police wouldn't want people running around that aren't deputized
Jimmy, thanks a lot for the call. Yes, there was an online campaign to try to bring civilians in, they said, to defend property and people against protesters or rioters if that ensued. Does that matter for the case, the trial, that much, John, why Rittenhouse was there in the first place?
Well, I think the prosecution has certainly made some arguments or tried to cast him in the light as being somebody who was an outsider, right, who came to Kenosha and had no connection to Kenosha, there was no good reason for him to essentially be there. There was certainly no good reason for him to be there with a rifle. There was some testimony, too, I think, about officers, you know, at least handing out water and thanking some of the folks who were there with rifles who claimed to be defending property. But ultimately, at the end of the day, the jury is not really being asked to decide whether or not it was a good idea for him to be there or whether or not he somehow was given permission to be there by the police officers. They're really just focused on, in his confrontations with those three people that he shot, was it reasonable at that time for him to use deadly force in self-defense?
Thanks for the call, Jimmy. We'll go to Karen now in Madison. Karen, hello.
Oh, first of all, I have to say concealed carry, open carry, all of that just opened a violence mechanism in this state. And you can see that in the statistics of shootings and the numbers of people buying guns. But I also, and this doesn't have anything to do with the trial, but I know that if this young man had been a person of color and done the same thing, and he would not have been able to walk through all of those police officers and leave, he would have been killed. And I know that for a fact. And we have a long way to go on what real justice is. And it's tragic that this young man did this. It's tragic that people encouraged him to by having hate. And it's tragic that the people died that they didn't need to die.
Karen, thanks a lot for the call. As Karen said, John, that probably won't be an issue or a direct factor in the trial. But do you have thoughts on some of those wider issues Karen raises there? And that certainly people are going to be thinking about when this trial ends, however it ends.
Yeah, there are several issues here that I think may resonate far beyond whatever the specific verdict is. I mean, one issue is, Wisconsin has both open carry and concealed carry. What is the wisdom of having or permitting open carry or concealed carry when you are at an event that is a protest, right? I mean, why permit both protesters or counter-protesters to go about armed and create a public safety concern in that instance? I mean, a lot of folks are also feel very strongly that, that an acquittal of Mr. Rittenhouse will somehow just highlight racial bias in the system, that because he is a young white man, he is going to be permitted to use deadly force against other people in a way that would never, our system would not have permitted a person of color in the same situation to have behaved in the same way. And this again touches on issues about, police use of force and the perception of our justice system as potentially racially biased. And so there are a lot of concerns with this case. I will say this. I mean, the verdict is not a referendum on any of those things. The verdict is not a referendum on the right to carry a gun. It's not a referendum on the right to protest. It really is. The jury's job is to stay focused on whether or not the prosecution has proven the specific charges against Mr. Rittenhouse beyond a reasonable doubt.
Karen, thanks for the call. Time for one more caller with Pat in Brookfield. Pat, hello.
Hello. Just a question for the professor. I found it somewhat interesting. It seemed like initially the prosecution was trying to prove that these individual interactions, so, one, two, and three, that Kyle Rittenhouse reasonably did not need to defend himself. It didn't reach that level, or he was the aggressor individually in these interactions. As the trial played on with the various testimony, even from the third victim, in addition to all of the video evidence, I'm wondering if they saw this as breaking their case, to where it seems now very recently, and in the closing arguments you heard today, they were talking a lot about provocation and the fact that Kyle Rittenhouse was just there with a gun, that automatically eliminates any self-defense. And I'm wondering if that's their strategy now because they understand that they're going to have a really hard time, or they did have a hard time, or frankly, they weren't able to make the connection to that the fact that he wasn't using reasonable self-defense in these individual interactions.
I got you, Pat. We're running short on time, so I'm going to cut you off. But, John, I've heard other people make that case that the prosecution seemed to switch gears in that way.
Yes. I think the prosecution has a real challenge in front of them. I mean, when they called Mr. Grosskreutz, he admitted on cross-examination that Mr. Rittenhouse did not shoot him until he was pointing a gun at him. And that seems to really make the defense's argument for them. And so with the evidence showing what it has showed in this case, I think now the prosecution may have decided that they needed to, as you said, shift gears a little bit and argue more broadly that just Mr. Rittenhouse's presence there, his presence armed in the way that he was, is sufficient provocation that would deny him the right to claim self-defense.
Thanks for that call. And just our last half minute, John, I, of course, won't ask you to predict what a jury will do, but you can leave us with a half minute or so of thoughts on the options before them here.
Well, I will say this. I think, you know, they have some difficult decisions to make in this case. One of the things that they will have to decide is even if Mr. Rittenhouse was even if he believed that subjectively that he was entitled to use self-defense, was it reasonable for him to think that? And if they find that, then it's possible that they could convict him of the second degree homicide charge. And frankly, I think that might be the prosecution's best hope for conviction, because there has been enough of a claim of self-defense in this case that I think, did he reasonably think he was entitled to use self-defense, or did he subjectively think so? Yes.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to John Gross from the UW Law School, looking at the Rittenhouse case, closing arguments happening today. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, when was the last time you randomly found something more than 1,000 years old? We'll talk to the diver who first discovered a dugout canoe in Madison's biggest lake from around the year 800. First, back in 1981, UW-Madison launched an effort to chronicle how people made and used maps. The plan was to produce a four-book series. The more the researchers dug in, the more insights they obtained. So they kept at it. Now, 40 years later, the project is starting to wind down. They just got a $350,000 grant from the National Endowment of the Humanities to help get it past the finish line. When complete, the History of Cartography project will consist of six giant volumes, each made up of about 1 million words, and of course, lots and lots of maps, from prehistory through the 20th century. Matthew Edney is the director of the History of Cartography project. He's also professor of geography and the Osher professor in the History of Cartography at the University of Southern Maine. Matthew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Can you talk about the origins of this project? What were they setting out to do with this massive collection?
That would take a very long time to explain. You can read my conclusion to volume 5 when it finally comes out, where I'll explain all this. But basically, my old advisor, David Woodward, who set up the project at Madison in 1981, and is really good collaborator and friend, a man called Brian Harley, were out walking in 1977 near Brian's house down in Devon in England. And Brian was muttering from his point of view that what the field needed is a coherent summary in four volumes of the mapping of the New World as a way to get everybody on the same page and not have everybody just keep reinventing the wheel, which they were sort of doing in the 70s. And David apparently shot right back saying, no, we need a four-volume history of cartography of the endeavor so that the entire field of map history, not just those people who study mapping of America, can be brought up to speed, as it were, and encouraged to pursue new directions.
Why are maps cool? What do they what does studying maps tell us about the people who made them, for whatever purpose they made them for?
Well, I'm biased, you know. I got bitten by the map bug when I was like 4 years old, 5 years old. So, I mean, to me, maps are just the most amazing thing. You can, on the one hand, if you have any sense of the nature of the environment and of human geography, you can use maps to understand early maps, to understand the past. You can look at past systems of agriculture and transportation and urbanization and so on. You can learn about the environment now, you can learn about the environment then. And if you become really nerdy and geeky about it, you can start to understand the concepts that societies hold about the world. You know, a lot of people think maps, you know, world maps, regional maps, show the world. But in reality, I've come to find that such maps show what the world ought to be. There's a subtle change in perspective. Maps are very idealized and very ideological. And so in studying early maps, you have to really engage with, frankly, the full breadth of human existence.
A lot of the Maps Project is available for people to see online. We've put up a link at wpr.org/centraltime. Can you give us a sense of the breadth of maps we're going to find when we start to
sure.
dig in?
So volume one was going to be all mapping and all cultures before 1450, 1492 or so, before 1500. And that pretty soon got narrowed down to the European tradition, Western tradition of Babylonia, Egypt, ancient Greece, Rome, medieval Europe. And so that's volume one, which came out in 87. They already made a decision well before that to take all the traditional Asian cultures that would originally have been part of volume one and make that a separate volume. And thinking that there wasn't much research done on that topic, so it wouldn't be very long, wouldn't be very big. And then they, however, pushed their authors to actually engage with maps as cultural documents, as social instruments. And next thing you know, volume two has grown into two large books, both bigger than volume one. Then there's the question about mapping by indigenous peoples, the history of indigenous cartography. A lot of that has been accomplished in the historical record in response to requests from Europeans and at various stages of the sort of the European globalization imperial project. And so Brian Hardy insisted that the indigenous map should be part of the various later volumes when imperial powers were engaging in the New World or in interior of Africa, for example. David always said, no, there needs to be a separate volume. And he won the argument because Brian unfortunately died in 91. And so History of Indigenous Cartography became volume two, book three, as big as volume one again. Then we have volume three, two large books on the European Renaissance, which covers everything from detailed studies of the different kinds of maps being made within different European cultures, but also bigger interpretive essays about the interrelationships of mapping and literature and mapping and science and art and so on. And then the fourth volume that's online for free is volume six, the 20th volume, 20th century volume, which covers all aspects of mapping in the present. It's an encyclopedic structure because you can't fit everything in otherwise. But it's everything from maps and political propaganda to maps and military technology and everything in between.
I understand your quote in a UW story is saying one of your favorite chapters is on Korean maps. Why did that touch you in particular?
Well, I know there's a bit of it is about the backstory. When David and Brian were trying to find people to write on a topic that no one's ever considered before, and they had to really sort of twist a few arms. And the first people they approached didn't necessarily come through. And so David had commissioned an initial chapter on Korean maps, and it really wasn't very good. And the reviewer for the press just didn't like it. And eventually, after David couldn't find anybody else to do it, he persuaded the press to actually ask the reviewer, would he do it? And fortunately, he said yes. And it's just this very tight essay that really gets into the political nature of mapping in early Korea, right up through into the 18th century, into the 19th century. The nature of Korean culture vis-a-vis the Chinese, vis-a-vis the Japanese, and the ways in which mapping progressively integrated into daily life, but in ways that are quite different from the ways in which they integrated in the West. So it's just a really nice example of how to do broad summary of map history that teaches you a lot without being very heavy going. This is a really great chapter.
Matthew, we'll leave it there. Thanks for sharing this with us.
Thank you very much.
Matthew Edney is a professor of geography at the University of Southern Maine, also director of the History of Cartography Project at UW-Madison. Talk to him about a new grant that'll help the UW team finish their work over the next few years, a four-decade project. You can see the maps and the essays at wpr.org/centraltime. We've got a link there. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary-Kate McCoy with a story about a quirky Wisconsin law.
For years, yellow margarine was illegal in Wisconsin. Why? Well, the history is a little complicated and a little bit strange, but its roots lie in Wisconsin's proud heritage as the dairy state. WPR's Jenny Peek brings us the story.
Wisconsin is America's dairyland. It's a title we take seriously. The state is home to over 1 million cows that produce almost 2.5 billion pounds of milk each month. We even host the World Dairy Expo. For Wisconsin lawmakers, it's an industry worth protecting, and its importance can be traced through a history of sometimes oddball laws. Ed Peel of Columbus, Ohio, reached out to WPR's Wisconsin about one such law. He visited his grandparents in Kenosha as a child and remembers the margarine being white instead of yellow. His grandfather had told him, "It's a Wisconsin law." So Peel asked Wisconsin, "Is that true?" It reminded me of a story I'd heard from my father-in-law, Rob Howell, who grew up in Kenosha. One of his chores as a boy was to mix the yellow dye into the margarine.
Of course, it came in these rectangular 1-pound packages with a little bead of yellow dye. And you had to break that bead and then spread it through the pound of oleo, which is very time consuming. But it was a god-awful mess, you know, because by the time you'd squeezed this oleo for 10 minutes, it had softened way up. Then you had to squirt it out into some sort of container. So it was always pretty unappetizing, but it was super unappetizing when it was white.
Not being able to buy yellow margarine in Wisconsin drove many residents, like the Howells, across state lines to buy the cheaper pre-mixed goods. Border towns like Waukegan, Illinois, boasted pop-up oleo stands advertising their product to traveling Wisconsinites.
Sometimes if we knew ahead of time that we were going to do that, we'd ask our neighbors if they wanted us to pick up a few pounds of colored oleo for them, and we often did, and so often came back with quite a haul of this illegal margarine.
Wisconsin started regulating margarine in 1881. Dave Driscoll, a curator at the Wisconsin Historical Society, says that while the laws have varied, the intent was simple: ensure fair prices for dairy products and prevent fraud.
The most durable objection to margarine was that it's fraudulent in that it's misrepresenting itself as butter. And, you know, it's kind of a pasty white by itself, which in the literature is referred to things like, you know, a corpse-like white, you know. So I think they felt that as long as it didn't look appealing, it didn't look like something delicious for your toast, that, you know, that was good enough.
But people got tired of the regulations and began pushing lawmakers to repeal them.
Throughout the Great Depression and then World War II rationing, more and more people actually had experience of consuming margarine. It was like, well, I've been eating this for years now. You know, it wasn't all that bad and it's significantly cheaper. So I should be able to buy this.
By 1953, only Minnesota and Wisconsin had laws banning yellow margarine. In 1963, Minnesota repealed its ban, leaving Wisconsin as the lone holdout. 4 years later, in 1967, Wisconsin joined the rest of the nation in legalizing yellow margarine. I asked Driscoll why it took so long.
I think in general, it's safe to say that the dairy interests in the state were as strong or stronger here than in most other states.
Even with yellow margarine legal, butter is the go-to spreadable fat in Wisconsin. It's a welcome change for Howell, who still remembers trying butter for the first time when he was 7.
I got one day at Forest Park Elementary School a hot lunch, and I tasted that and was immediately impressed at how much better it was than margarine, which is terrible. And went home with that and was told by my mom that it was butter was too expensive and unhealthy.
But once it was up to him, he steered clear of oleo.
I haven't eaten margarine, at least knowingly, for probably 50 years.
This story came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future story. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, what can a recently discovered 1,200-year-old canoe tell us about how indigenous people in the Madison area lived and fished? We'll meet the diver who found the artifact at the bottom of Madison's Lake Mendota. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. What does it feel like to discover something? The moment of curiosity, of wonder, of questioning whether the thing you found might have already been discovered? And then there's what happens next, finding out what it adds to our understanding of things. Our next guest recently experienced a bit of this when she discovered what turned out to be a canoe more than 1,000 years old sunk in Lake Mendota. Tamara Thompson is a diving instructor and a maritime archaeologist with the Wisconsin Historical Society. Tamara, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, take us underwater with you, Tamara, to when you initially spotted this. What did you see? What did you think?
Well, it was a Saturday afternoon and finally had a Saturday off. And I invited one of the girls from the dive shop to go diving with me out in Lake Mendota. In the spring, we have really good conditions in our local lakes. And we took diver propulsion vehicles. They're like a little fan with a battery. And we were... scootering, it was pulling us along the wall. We were kind of chasing down some fish that hang out along the wall. And about the time we were ready to stop, Mallory signaled that it was her turnaround time. And I looked under where she had stopped and I saw the end of a dugout canoe protrude, or what I thought was a dugout canoe protruding from the slope. So she signaled we had to go back. In fact, I got out my my slate and I wrote, I think that's a dugout canoe. And she signaled we needed to go back to the boat because it was her turnaround time. And when we got back to the boat, I asked if she wanted to grab another tank and go back and check it out and make sure it wasn't just a log. And she had some other things to do that afternoon. So I got a hold of a coworker, a terrestrial archaeologist that specializes in the late woodland population. And her name is Amy Roseborough. And I asked if she wanted to come sit on the boat with me, if I could go back and try to find where we had last seen the canoe.
You went back, you found it. Now, how did we get from, okay, it is a boat, to it's a 1,200-year-old boat?
Yeah, so when I was with Amy, I took a camera down and took some pictures. It's one of those chicken egg situations, right? Do you clean off the canoe and see and expose it and see if it actually is a canoe or a log, or do you leave it and then it's not exposed to the elements? And well, I cleaned it off, took pictures. We discovered that it was filled with net sinkers. Or what later we didn't know as net sinkers. And We took the photos back to the Historical Society and went through committee. They decided that since I had exposed it, it was exposed to the elements. We have zebra mussels that are our local lakes. Algaes can get into the canoe. And it was determined that we should find out how old it was at the very least. So our new state archaeologist, Jim Skibo, came in and had me go down and get a little sliver of the canoe, which he sent in for radiocarbon dating. And I have to say, I was absolutely surprised when it came back with the age of 800 AD. We had a little bet in the office, and I was betting that it was like a 1950s Boy Scout canoe because it was in such good shape.
So you've got, it's in great shape, but it's at risk of deteriorating. What is the process of bringing a 1,200-year-old canoe out of a lake without damaging it?
Well, you first need to consult with the local tribes. And I think that was one of the first steps that the Historical Society did was send notice out to them to get feedback. And, you know, we received support from a number of the tribes. And we decided then to put a team together. We needed manpower. And so I asked the local sheriff department, the Dane County Sheriff Department, if they would be willing to participate in helping us excavate and lift. Turns out that they had their last dive day of the season was the 2nd of November. And because most of the guys work third shift in the jail, it was hard to pull them from their regular schedule. So that became our hard and fast date for when we were going to lift it. And then my coworker, Caitlin Zant, and I, and a few other volunteers from the Historical Society that we have in, that have us have help, working with us in the diving program, went out and excavated the canoe the week before. And with the help of the sheriff department and Randy Wallander, who does a little commercial work along the coast, we were able to create a plan to lift this thing and get it to the surface.
Now, the people who use this boat for fishing, presumably in the lake, were maybe some of the same people who built the famous effigy mounds in our area. As you've been working on this project, what kind of things you've been thinking about, wondering about what this boat tells us about life here 1,200 years ago?
It's pretty amazing. I mean, we've never found a ship from this era and not in Lake Mendota and not this deep. And in fact, one of the points that Jim brought up was that we haven't found another craft with a cache of these net sinkers. So to understand that they were using these nets in our local lakes here in Madison area is pretty significant.
I know you've done Great Lakes shipwreck work in the past. Does this make you want to spend more time in inland lakes to see if you can find more finds like this?
I'm sure there's a lot more things out there. Most of our funding for our projects have been related to the Great Lakes, and so that's really been our focus for the last 32 years of our program. There's a lot more to discover just very close to home.
And what is next for this dugout canoe? It's been dug out, and what now?
Yeah, so we brought it back to the beach and hand-loaded it into a trailer, and the DNR conservation warden drove it across town to the state archive and preservation facility. And there's a custom-built tank that's there, and it is sitting in water right now at that facility. It will sit there for about 2 years. So it goes through a process with polyethylene glycol, and there's two molecular weights of that will be added to the water to displace the water that's in the cells of the waterlogged canoe. This will allow it to be stable. After about 2 years of that, then it's going to be sent to another facility for freeze drying. And so we'll see it back here in about 3 years, and hopefully it'll provide a good contribution for our understanding of the peoples that lived here before us.
Tamara, thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Tamara Thompson is a maritime archaeologist with the Wisconsin Historical Society. We talked to her today about an ancient canoe she found at the bottom of Madison's Lake Mendota and what the boat can tell us about the people who lived in the area more than 1,000 years ago. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a wrongfully convicted Wisconsin man became a lawyer to help prevent cases like his. We'll meet the author of the new book, Redeeming Justice. And is political polling worth keeping around? I guess makes the case that polls may mislead us more than they help us. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.